Good afternoon, everybody. My name's Martin Kiernan. I'm a nurse consultant in infection prevention and I work in Southport in the northwest of England. It's my great pleasure to be able to welcome you to the first of the 2014 British Teleclass series. Today's speaker is Dr. Yvonne Curran, who's a nurse consultant in infection prevention working for Health Protection Scotland. I've had the pleasure of knowing Yvonne now for in excess of 20 years. When I first met her, she was an infection control nurse working at Glasgow Royal Infirmary. She did her diploma in infection control in 1990 with Glasgow University and later did a master's in public health in 1994 at the same university. She's recently completed her Doctor of Nursing in 2001 and that was undertaken at Stirling University. Yvonne's been working on an outbreak programme at Health Protection Scotland since 2006. And has written a very well-received outbreak column for the Journal of Infection Prevention since 2012. Yvonne is one of those people I will always travel out of my way to hear speak. She speaks with passion, she speaks with knowledge, and she has a very common sense and practical approach to infection prevention. So who better to speak to us today on the subject of the utility of human error theory and high reliability in outbreaks? Welcome, Yvonne.
Well, thank you to Martin for that introduction and welcome everyone to Glasgow, the European City of Culture 1990 and the host of the 2014 Commonwealth Games. So we'll move on to slide two. Martin's already given you some information about who I am. So this is me if people don't know what I look like. I've been working in infection control, as Martin says, since 87. And in the outbreak programme of work specifically here at Health Protection Scotland since 2006. Let's move to slide three. So one of the important things that I do to try and stay up to date and on top of the topic area is write an outbreak column. So here's some of the later columns that we have done. And it really helps me to keep up to date. But what I'm going to talk about today is not one of these specific topics, but outbreak management in general, and how it fits into the current theories of improving patient safety through error reduction. Now, when I was making up the slides, if there was key authors or some nice websites, I've put them at the bottom of the slides, and I hope that you take the time to have a look at these. So let's begin properly with slide four. So the title of this presentation is The Utility of Human Error Theory and High Reliability Theory in Outbreaks. And the first thing to make clear is how these are going to be useful to you in your practice. And if any of you, maybe old like me, didn't actually grow up when we used they used to teach through a lot of theories, I just want to refer you to a great adage that was said by Kurt Lewin. There's nothing so practical as a good theory. And please believe me when I say that theories are not just for the scientists. Okay, so let's go on to slide five. There are three key points I want to get over in this talk. And the first one is that if we understand errors and how they arise, we can produce tools that make these errors less likely. And the second point is that if we really understand what you need to have or how you need to behave to make a system highly reliable, then we can build this into our ways of working, which will greatly improve the safety of our system. And finally, we need to understand that just because we set out to do a good job, it doesn't mean that we're going to do that good job. We can make a bad situation worse. There's lots of errors that happen when people try to put things right. None of the above that we've talked about here is directly related to traditional infection prevention science fields. But if we add this to what underpins infection control, we will increase our potential to make this safer for our patients. Let's move to slide six. Now what you'll see is I've changed the adage. It's not just to err is human, it's to err is both human and system. And I will provide evidence for this throughout the talk. What I'm specifically going to cover is what errors cause outbreaks. I want to demonstrate the tools that can reduce risk, and I want to introduce you to so human error theory and high reliability theory. So let's go to slide 7. So what do we want to know, or what do we know about the causes of outbreaks? When we talk about the cause of outbreaks, we usually know the organism that caused it, and that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about the causation transmission pathway. We know the organism, we sometimes know the reservoirs, we know the outbreak infection category, for example, was it a bloodstream infection or surgical site infection, but we don't always know the route that the outbreak organism took from the reservoir to the patient. Now, before we go to the next slide, I'm going to warn you, it's busy, but I think it will be of value. So as you've been warned that it's busy, let's take a move. Okay, we're on to slide 8, and this is a piece of work, took a long time to produce, that I did for outbreak column 10. And basically what it is, or what I think it is a list of all the different ways, perhaps a map is a better word, of all the different ways that you can get an infection in a care setting. So on the left-hand side, the green boxes are where the pathogens are, and on the right-hand side are the infection stations. And it does look a bit like an underground map, certainly a London underground map. There's a key point for all this. If you want to read how that map works, you can get outbreak column 10. But the key point from this schematic is on the next slide, so slide 9. And that is this, that the pathogens, pathways, and new hosts necessary for outbreaks are present in every healthcare system every day. And that's a critical point. And what that means is, what stops us having outbreaks every day is good infection prevention and control. And we have that most days of the week, but we don't have it every day of the week. And the ingredients for outbreaks are omnipresent, critical factor. Okay, so let's move on to slide 10. Now, slide 10 has got another couple of very salient points. And the first one is this, that it's never one thing that goes wrong. It's always lots of things that conspire together. So the day I wrote this slide, I got very wet coming to work. Why did I get wet? Well, the simple answer is that it rained very heavily. But for goodness sake, it's Glasgow. It rains nearly every day. It could be like Seattle. It happens that often. So what else happened that day to make me very wet? Well, the battery died in my car, so I had to get the bus, and I had to walk about half a mile to the bus stop. And somebody, I don't know who, and I kid you not, changed all the numbers of the buses. And I thought I got on the right bus, but I got on the wrong bus, and I finished up a further half mile away from where I thought I would be. So the simple answer is I got wet because it rained, but the full answer includes lots of other things that conspired to make me wet through. Now, the other important point on this slide is the triangle at the bottom. The circumstances that caused the event, whatever the event is, in this case it's an outbreak, probably happened before, but with a different result. I went to work many times before, I got the bus many times before, but I didn't always get wet. In 1987, the Herald of Free Enterprise, which was a big roll-on, roll-off ferry, tipped up outside Zeebrugge Harbour, and a bow door was wide open. But the investigation determined she had set sail many times before with the bow doors opened. She tipped up just once. So this is similar to other big infections or outbreaks. For example, Staph aureus bacteremia arises, amongst other things, because of infected peripheral catheters. But there are many peripheral catheters that get infected that don't actually cause Staph aureus bacteremia. And this is Heinrich's industrial accident model, i.e. the triangle. And he suggests that for every major disaster, there are many more minor disaster or near misses. So for outbreaks, it's perhaps poor practice, but no cross-transmission or infection arising. Or it's cross-transmission, but perhaps no infection. And only a very few events actually lead to an outbreak. And quite often one of the problems we face is trying to communicate to staff, this is a problem or this is an unsafe act. And the response might be something like, well, you know, we've always done it this way, and we've never had a problem before. And whilst that may be true, it doesn't make the act safe. There is still a big risk there. So those are key points to bear in mind. So let's progress to slide 11. And slide 11 is about terminology, specifically between unsafe acts and outbreak-provoking conditions. And Reason's terminology is here. Reason is the key author for this whole methodology. Others have taken it and developed it. He's absolutely the key author. So if he's not one of the people you have on watch, you really need to. So Reason's terminology here is very useful. I'm going to be illustrating his Swiss cheese model later on. Now, what he says is the causes or the last things that happen, these unsafe acts, provoke the outbreak. They enable the outbreak to happen. So that could be a failure of hand hygiene, a failure to isolate the patients. It could be the fact that we've used a contaminated substance for an injection. But what provoked the unsafe act could have been shortages of staff, a lack of a single room, a lack of training on recognizing that people have potentially infectious diseases, or that vials that can be used more than once, which enables somebody to use them more than once. So these outbreak-provoking conditions are very important, and when we come to identify what actually happened in this outbreak, understanding the systems, it's very important that we're able to separate out the unsafe acts from the outbreak-provoking conditions. It's imperative we do that. If we just end up with people didn't wash their hands enough, we're not doing anyone a service here. So let's move on to slide 12. And given what we know went on before, what we're asking for here is, well, who's to blame? Is it the system designers, or is it the frontline workers? Or it might even be we consider it to be the Chancellor of the Exchequer, and that's the door signalling in UK where the Chancellor of the Exchequer lives. He's the man who decides where money gets spent. Now, further developing that, we're going to say, is it a bad system or bad people? So we're on slide 13 now. And we have to accept there are a very few bad people. These people set out to cause harm. In UK, we can think of Beverly Allett, we can think of Harold Shipman, Colin Norris. These are people who have been found guilty of doing bad things and setting out to do bad things. There are other people who behave recklessly, and they don't set out to actually cause harm, but they take such risks that where the harm happens is a matter of indifference to them. The technician who's in the press recently in America, who used patients' drugs and left Hep C contaminated syringes behind, behave recklessly. There are also failures to follow process. Now, these might be provoked by some of the conditions we talked about earlier. But there are also failures of process. And there's a very nice short report in MMWR from the CDC 2 weeks ago about a failure of a decontamination process. And what the CDC said in its report was the decontamination process was as it should have been, i.e. the process itself wasn't good enough. So this is not a frontline problem. This is a new problem that has to be addressed. The process needs to be changed, or something else in addition needs to happen. So these are distinctions that are very important and need to be made. So let's move to slide 14 now. So what I want you to understand, it's not a case of who is to blame, but we need to understand how errors happened and, as far as possible, design them out. And if ever we can get upstream enough, we want to design out the errors before they happen. So let's move to slide 15. And it's good to take a pause at this point in time and to stop and say, right, what are we actually trying to do here? Now, if somebody stops you and asks you, what do you do? And they want an answer in a sentence and not a paragraph, what would you say? Well, I'll be honest, it took me about a week to come up with what I would say. And what I would say now is I assist in the prevention of preparedness for, and the management of outbreaks. And all of these are vital, but they're different. And a question to always ask yourself at the end of the outbreak is, how did you, or the IPCT, Infection Prevention and Control Team, affect the epicurve? If you recognised the outbreak after it peaked, applied the control measures after the peak, could you have done it quicker? What in your own system would have helped you to do that quicker? I have seen some people present data on a significant outbreak that went on for quite a long period of time, and that was recognised well after the event was over. And although they put together a very good what happened, they didn't affect the incident at all. But they made a very nice story to explain what had happened. And I'm sure perhaps they did good work to prevent it happening again, but actually didn't do anything to change the shape of the epicurve. And that's really what we want to do. And the outcome of what we do should perhaps be measured by data that shows that we reduce the incidence and we reduce the size of outbreaks. So we reduce the incidence of outbreaks and the impact of outbreaks. So a question for you to consider after the seminar amongst yourselves, if you're listening with Teams, or perhaps if you're not listening with Teams, going back and asking them, is what examples have you got where you can actually show we changed the shape of the epicurve? And it's a good thing to build on. So we'll move to slide 16, and this is where we really get going on human error theory. This is what it's all about. It actually isn't an official theory, but as you'll see from the definition of theory, what I've put at the end of the presentation, the definition of a theory is that it's an accepted as a valid explanation of a phenomenon, and certainly reasons work is generally accepted as that. So what we've got in human error theory, and what we've said already, is that the outbreaks involve unsafe acts and outbreak-provoking conditions. The unsafe acts can be performed by frontline workers and infection prevention and control teams. And the outbreak-provoking conditions are produced by people who design and resource the system. And that they can be caused by lots of different things, or there's lots of different examples with regard to that. So once again, if you take a look at that, that fits well with the person and with the system. So we will progress to slide 17. Now slide 17 illustrates the Swiss cheese model. There are errors or holes in the cheese, in the slices of the cheese, Emmental cheese, and these represent gaps or weaknesses in the different layers of the system. So the organisation and culture is very important. It sets the whole scene. The current conditions of work are what happened on the day. The organisation and culture can be very safety conscious, have everything going, very good culture in reporting safety and striving for safety. But the current conditions of work, what happened on the day, if half the staff go off sick, whatever reason, you can get holes appearing. And these holes, as reason says, don't stay in one position. They open and close. They become safe and unsafe. So the next one is the unsafe acts. We've talked about them. And in the final slice of the cheese is the defences. But more often than not in healthcare, there's a complete absence of defences. It's not that the defence system itself failed. And you can see good defences. I'm going to use a car analogy, having already said that my battery died. But when you open your car door and your lights are on, that's a defence for your battery. But when something goes wrong in healthcare, we quite often, certainly when it's in relation to contamination of hands or contamination of a drug, we can't see it. There's nothing to alert us that actually we have a problem, we have a contamination going on. So let's take a look at how this works in a real outbreak on the next slide. So this is an example of an endoscopy-related outbreak. So what could happen in the organisation and culture? Well, there could well be mixed messages. The most important thing in any system is never infection prevention and control. It's always something else. And for endoscopy, it might well be the safety-related aspects of the procedure. But it could also be the most important thing is that we get everyone through the waiting list. It might be that, you know, we've got 10 people to do, they've all got to be done by 5 o'clock. Let's just head down and hats on and go through. So the culture is keep them going, keep the list turning over. There isn't perhaps time or resources to do anything else. So that's perhaps the organisation and culture. For the current conditions of work, it will never be a good day. It will be a bad day. A scope will be away for repair. There will be insufficient staff. There will be several tasks that need to be done by one person at the one time. That can't happen. And there will always be a miscommunication in there somewhere, and perhaps a failure of a direct communication about a decontamination a procedure that's maybe been done or maybe not been done well. The unsafe act will be the fact that we use the scope, and the lack of a defence will be that there was no information to indicate that the scope being used was contaminated. Or perhaps a lack of clarity, a wrong assumption being made. And once again, if we can draw a line through the holes in the Swiss cheese slices, there will be a failure. Okay, let's move to slide 19. And what I've done on slide 19 is list some of the inherent weaknesses that are in our healthcare systems. Now, I'm only going to talk about the ones that are in blue. And the big one at the top is the continuously changing healthcare. And what changes are the populations, the actual healthcare that we deliver itself, and the environment. And sometimes we design in outbreak risks. I'll give you an example of that. And sometimes there are competing priorities, and cost is a competing priority. And perhaps waiting lists, certainly over the recent years, waiting lists have been a competing priority. Now, to give you an example of how things have changed, one of the outbreak columns that I'm writing at the minute is about Staph aureus outbreaks. And I'm comparing the Staph aureus outbreaks that happened in 1959 or up to 1959 and the Staph aureus outbreaks that happened from 2010 right up to date. Now, in 1959, they only happened in maternity units, mother and baby units, and they only happened in surgical wards. That was the entire stock that were published. But today, you get, or certainly from 2010, what you're getting is outbreak reports, still a few in the maternity and mum and baby units, fewer in surgical site infections, but the NICU, very commonplace to get Staph aureus outbreaks, burns units are commonplace to get Staph aureus outbreaks, and outpatient settings. There are four reports of pain clinics or injection clinics where the injection's been contaminated and people have developed very serious infections, not obviously around in the 1950s. So what this shows is, well, the populations have changed, the healthcare's changed, and the environment's changed. So let's take a look at how we can design in an outbreak. So what we see on slide 20 is a man being admitted with red spotted dot disease. And he goes into a four-bedded area because perhaps the doctor doesn't recognise red spotted dot disease as an infection, or because that's the only place that we can put him. And there are three other people in there, and guess what happens to them? They get red spotted dot disease too, and we've got another patient in there almost within less than 24 hours. And if we progress to slide 21, what you can see that in 24 hours plus, we will ship out to three other wards and perhaps to another hospital red spotted dot disease. And this medical receiving or urgent medical care wards are great ways to receive a diagnosis very, very quickly. So for urgent care and you want a quick diagnosis, you want to be in one of these places. However, if you were going to design a ward to cause an outbreak through your care system, you'd be hard-pressed to come up with a better way than to design a ward where you bring in lots of people who are acutely ill, that have got difficult to recognise diseases, And then you ship them out all over the places to other wards where they don't have them. So obviously there is no such thing as red-spotted dot disease, but there is norovirus, and there are other types of infections that when they come in through urgent care can very rapidly spread throughout a hospital system. So here's a system designed to give great urgent care, but is at risk of causing outbreaks. So let's go to slide 22. And what slide 22 is going to do is take a look at each of these cheese slices individually. So the first one is organization and culture. And these can affect both the clinical team and the IPCT. We can all do these. So number one is a poor safety culture. Perhaps we tolerate, or this area tolerates, violations in practice. You know what? If my colleague doesn't do hand hygiene, so what? I'm not picking up my best friend. And I remember asking a nurse once, if you saw your best friend not doing hand hygiene, would you tell him? And the answer was no, but I'd tell a doctor. Well, that's not a great safety culture. We have to be able to create this culture where we're going to pick up colleagues if we make a mistake. We might make erroneous assumptions of safety. It's okay to make beds and to do the dressings at the same time. It's okay to batch drugs because we really don't have enough time to do it. And hey, it's quicker if you do it that way. We might admit to open bays regardless of the patient's symptoms. And sometimes, I think quite wrongly, we have given a lot of people too many boxes to tick. And to such an extent that the message is tick the box. That's what the job is, tick the box. It's not about what the box is saying should be done. It might be that alert signals are not a priority. There are other competing targets. We might simplify reasons for data variation. Oh, it always goes up at this time of year. Oh, that's not a very good a way to look at data. We might not involve experts when we need to, and that's very important. That was one of the things that went wrong in a lot of the C. diff outbreaks early on. We didn't involve people who were expert in looking after specific care aspects for these patients. There might be a lot of external pressures, perhaps time, so there's workarounds to get this done. We might not share learning from past events. They might not have enough funding to do what we're doing. And there might be poor attitudes to error. If somebody's going to get shouted at if they report an error, they're not going to report the error. And so we're not going to make our system safe. So these are some examples of organization and culture that can make us error prone. If we go on to slide 24, we'll take a look at the system defenses. Actually, I went over two. I'm going to go back on to slide 23, which is the current conditions of work. So, as I said already, you could have a really good organization and culture, and it goes wrong on the day. So what can go wrong is the people. You might not have enough. The environment might be poor or poorly maintained. There might be a lot of splashes where you have to make up a procedure or a dug. That will certainly aid in causing contamination. There might be few indicators about that there's a problem. With regard to the equipment, it might be difficult to clean, it might be poorly maintained, and it might just not show when it's actually a problem with it. We might have very good SOPs, but perhaps they're locked in a cupboard, they're not accessible, or there isn't actually enough time to actually go through them line by line. And that can happen in some of the work, or some of the SOPs that are available. So for system defences, what's there? There might be nothing or little to indicate equipment or the contamination's contaminated. The environment is contaminated. There might be little to prevent contamination becoming cross-transmission. And the risks in some people are undetectable. Certainly in my reading of Staph aureus outbreaks, there are lots of instances when a healthy person has been found to disseminate vast quantities of Staph aureus. No skin disease, nothing to suggest that this is the case, but that's just what happens. So the green ones there are the clinical team. For the ICT, our system defences might just be inadequate surveillance or a lack of a backup or perhaps a failure in oversight to check. Yeah, I agree with you. I think that's what that situation is. Now, if we progress to slide 25, will see the unsafe acts by the clinical team, and these are basically all a failure to follow standard infection control precautions. And the commonest ones will be in the use of PPE, hand hygiene, and very important at the moment, safe injection practices. There are too many outbreaks reported where the safe injection practices procedures went awry. And patient placement, we've talked about already. If we don't put a patient in a good position, i.e. a single cubicle, then we can have problems. The other steps are important, but those are the key ones. Slide 26. So this is just summing up now. So errors in the system occur in the Swiss cheese slices of organisation and culture, of current conditions of work, unsafe acts, and the lack of or a failure of defences. And what we haven't talked about already are the specific errors that the IPCTs commit, and we're going to progress to that just now. So again, on slide 27, this is the work of Reason, and these are the unsafe acts that the IPCTs do, but also the unsafe acts that others do. This just describes them. Now, for an unsafe act, the first category is whether we intend to do it or we don't intend to do it. The unintended unsafe acts are things like slips and lapses. So there's a slipping when you're doing a procedure or you fall on the floor. That, well, you certainly didn't intend to fall on the floor. These are generally skill-based and attention failure. Lapses tend to be a memory failure, and I'm not 21 anymore, unfortunately, so I get a few more of these to the pound, but we are all prone to forget, and it's the commonest error we do is omission errors. So we didn't intend to forget a step, but we do forget a step. And quite often when I used to go back to my office after doing visits or what have you, I would always sit down and go, oh no, I forgot to tell them this, or I forgot to tell them that. These are omission errors. Okay, so coming down to our intended acts, we have mistakes. And mistakes fall into two categories. They are rule-based and they're knowledge-based. And we'll take a look at these rules as we go on. I'm not going to discuss violations because I'm fortunate never to have come across an incident of violations by an infection prevention and control team, and I hope never to do so. So let's progress to slide 28. So what are the skill-based slips and lapses for the IPCT? Well, there might be poor alert signal detection and investigation. There's always the potential for poor communication, and I refer you to Lingard, very good work on communication, and she describes four types of errors. We tell too few people, we tell them too little information, we don't tell them why we're telling them what we're telling them, and we tell them too late. So a very good categorization of communications, and we're all very prone to that. We might also fail to investigate and remove all reservoirs and improve the system after the outbreak is over. And another key one is that we can lose situational awareness. We either have wrong data or we have a wrong interpretation of data, and that leads to poor decision making. So if we go on to slide 29, there's a nice definition here of situational awareness. It's an up-to-date understanding of the situation in a constantly changing environment. We never have all the information that we need in outbreak investigations and what have you. It's very easy to misinterpret data or to misunderstand what things are going on. I'm going to give you some examples of what we can do to try and help this type of error now. And I'm very fond of the Berwick saying that if you can't write down what you're doing as a procedure, you don't know what you're doing. So before we go on to, we're going to take a look at alert signals now, just have a second to think about it. Do you think all of your colleagues in your team would assess an alert signal in the same way you would? And if not, how can we get them to think and to all do it to the same standard? Okay. Key, if we're going to not lose situational awareness, is system design, teamwork, training and practice, and I'll be highlighting them. So here's slide 30. Now, slide 30 came about after I'd read about 100 papers on pseudo-outbreak reports. And that enabled me to produce this. And what I was really looking for was one of the things that we have on an algorithm I'm going to show you about outbreaks in a minute, is when you get an alert signal, what you do is you determine whether or not it's real. And people often say to me, yeah, but what do? And I said, well, you use your experience. And it was very hard to put it in words, but writing for that paper enabled me to do this. So let's go through it. So you've got an alert signal. An alert signal comes either from laboratory data, clinical data, or surveillance data. And the first thing you do is say, is it real? Is there an increase above the background level? And once we're at that point, we then start to get some critical information. And the first question is, are the patients infected? Or are they all sitting up in bed, eating their chips? So if the patients are infected, the next question that we have to ask is, are the cases linked? Now, if they're all infected and they're all coming from the same ward, it's quite clear. We're at box one, and we're in an infection outbreak, and we will investigate it as an outbreak. Sometimes you don't have all the information that you need to be able to make that decision promptly, and it may be only after you've gone a long way down that investigation process that you get some detailed microbiology or some other key pieces of information that says, you know what, these actually weren't linked at all. But that's just life. We have to treat it like an outbreak if it presents like an outbreak. So if we say our patients are infected and the cases are not linked, then we've got a pseudo-outbreak. We've got an unrelated cluster of real infections. And the next thing we want to look at is whether the method of doing surveillance has changed. We might have done a lot more tests, so we're going to get a lot more positives. We might have changed the test. The person who makes the diagnosis might have been new and have a higher level of suspicion that there is an infection compared to somebody else. These are all reasons that suggest that what you've got is a surveillance testing artifact. In one of the ones that I was reading about for the pseudo-outbreak paper was where the doctors had could only use a certain antibiotic if they diagnosed an infection. So you know what? They diagnosed infections. They didn't really have infections. They just wanted to carry on using the antibiotic that they were using. So that's an artifact. Other than that, it would be due to chance. So, but we'd still keep monitoring it. Now, if we go back up and we say, are the patients infected? And the answer is no, we then would ask the question, has exposure occurred? And this is where there's something different in this particular schematic to others that you might have seen. Because if exposure has occurred, and it has occurred in a healthcare setting, then the only thing that's different between that and a real outbreak and an infection outbreak is we got lucky and the patient didn't get sick. So we should investigate that as a real outbreak and stop exposure, because that will stop potential infections later on. So last arrow then down is that if the patients are not infected and they have not been exposed, this is when it's either a laboratory error or there's something in the taking of the specimen, maybe it's contaminated specimen containers from the get-go, that is causing this problem. And that's a pseudo-outbreak. And there are other examples. Sometimes when they take blood from neonates, they will put blood in blood cultures last, but perhaps do several other investigations first. And perhaps in doing that, they will contaminate the blood before it goes into the bottle. There's quite a few examples of that. However, here's something that you can use to assess alert signals and to reduce variation in decision-making. So another slide, slide 31, is just going to show you about data presentation. And it's very important that you can very quickly turn data into a presentation, because what you want to do with that data is infer. And what you want to infer from it and do with that information is make the best possible decisions for your patients. So there are lots of pieces of kit out there now that will make an EpiCurve for you very quickly, that will present data for you very quickly, but I'm a firm believer, like sailors, we should all be able to navigate without a GPS. So make sure your team can come up with some essential data presentations very quickly. Okay, so let's go on to slide 32. This is another example. A lot of wards, and this is obviously a ward plan, have got the same footprint. So it's very easy to make these up, have them ready in advance, because some of the people involved in an outbreak situation might not know what your ward looks like. And you want to get everyone on the same page very quickly. So you can, by using this, show where toilets are, where wash hand basins are, and this will help you when you've got patients on the ward who are sick, some who've been exposed, some who've never been exposed. What does the four footprint look like, and where is it safest to look after these patients? You have to also be mindful that although the outbreak is manifesting on the ward, it could actually have been occurring somewhere else. Perhaps it's been generated in theatre. And what information you have or what you see is not all there is that needs to be seen. You will never have all the data that you want in an outbreak. But it's very important that you use what data you have very well so we get those best decisions made. Slide 33 then is going to talk about a checklist. And I'm sure you've probably all heard of Gawande, Peter Provenos, and James Reason. These are all people that have written extensively on outbreaks, on checklists. And there are two types. There's a read-do, and there's a do-confirm-done. So the read-do is a read in a recipe, separate the eggs, add the flour, you read the instruction, and you do it. In an outbreak-type situation, what you're looking for is a do-confirm-done. So you have a whole list of actions that you need to do, and you want to mentally check them off. And if you have a list that you've agreed in advance, it won't have any steps missing. And a key tip is don't wait for an outbreak to practice how to do it. Let's go to slide 34, and this is the checklist that we have at Health Protection Scotland, and I still use it for all the outbreaks that I help to support. On one side of the algorithm, on one side of the checklist is an algorithm, and that simply describes how an outbreak should progress. So again, we've got three key questions that we're going to ask here. Once we've identified our alert signal and said it is an outbreak, we're going to put in place control measures. Then we're going to investigate and perhaps put in place some further control measures. PHV is patient healthcare worker visitor. That's a rank order that people go down in an outbreak. And once our control measures are in place, our key question is, are they working? And if they're working, we then want to say, well, is it now safe to go back to normal? So that's how an outbreak should progress. And on the other side is our checklist and all of the steps that we need to do in an outbreak situation are there listed. There are lots of voluminous policies and documents that are written about outbreaks and for outbreaks, but generally and when you're in an outbreak situation, you don't have time for a big policy. You need something that's very swift and to the point, and that's what we have here. I hope that's what we have here. So far, the tools that we've talked about are to reduce the unsafe acts of slips, omission errors, forgetting a step, and they're all around checklists. So let's take a look at what sort of mistakes we make for rule-based errors. So we will progress to the next slide. Okay, three types of rule-based error that we can make. We can apply the wrong control measures, we can apply the right control measures badly, or we don't apply any control measures at all. So the wrong control measures are a patient who's got TB, and we're not applying airborne precautions. We can apply the right control measures badly, and that's going to be your norovirus, where you close the ward for a day. And in actual fact, that's just not long enough for a norovirus outbreak, as we all know. And we might not apply norovirus control measures at all, and that clearly would be the wrong thing to do. So if we progress to slide 36, what we can see is we've got some tools here now. These are trigger tools that will help us apply the right control measures. So one's a CDI trigger tool and one's a generic trigger tool. So the CDI trigger tool, very simply, we have that because we've got one disease caused by one organism. We know how it spreads, so we know what control measures we need in place to prevent further cases and to prevent onward transmission. And we've also put together a generic control measure trigger tool because the control measures that we apply in any outbreak don't actually change much. The investigations might change, but the control measures overall, with minor modifications, are the same. So these are two examples of tools that we've got for rule-based errors. They contain a go-no-go assessment. Is this trigger real, is what it's saying. And then actions that you need to do as soon as you say, yep, we've got an outbreak situation going on here, and actions that you need to take every day until you close the incident. And what's very important is the little thing at the bottom there. We don't know everything, and we certainly can't remember everything. And if we go on to the next slide, 37, what we'll see is a checklist for norovirus outbreaks. And again, like CDI, it's one organism causing one type of infection, so it's very easy to write the rules, and here's our checklist to make sure that's been all done. So what we've got to reduce our rule-based errors are these types of checklists that we can hopefully put in place, communicate with our clinical teams to reduce the risk. So what's left are our knowledge-based errors, and they're shown on slide 38. And these are slightly different. They're caused by what's called bounded rationality, i.e. we don't have all the information that we need to. One there is an incomplete checklist, and the incomplete checklist is that we tend to produce a checklist in our heads, all right, we'll do that, that, and that, and then you've done that, that, and that, but actually you needed a few more steps in that process that weren't on your list. We can get overconfident in our decisions, and we get very pleased with them. It's a nice decision. That was caused by that. That was caused by something else. Everyone's supporting our theory. It all sounds good. But we don't question it enough. The other things that can happen is we can hold on to the initial theory. So we think the outbreak was caused by X or Y or whatever it was. And when we get more data that says, actually, that's nonsense, it was so nice, that theory, that we were very reluctant to let it go. We can oversimplify causation. We've talked a little bit about that already. And an example of that would be, I always remember going up to a ward and saying, sister, we've got a problem. We've got two cases of Staph aureus or Streptococcus. And she would always say to me, yep, that'll be theatre. Now, that's an oversimplification of causation. And we had to remind her that, or not remind her, but just encourage her to dig a bit deeper and to work with us on this one. And the last one you see, I've put down the bottom, James Reason and Daniel Kahneman, very good book, Thinking Fast and Slow. And one of the things he says is that we quite often make decisions when we think that everything that we can see, or all that we can see, is all that is. And that's Wisatti. What you see is all there is. And one of the things that's going into outbreak column 14 is a line, and it's that the jigsaw puzzles that are handed to IPCTs to put together seldom contain all the pieces. So it's very important that we think about these causation very carefully and don't get overconfident. We really work hard to prove what we say is real. So how are we going to solve these problems? Let's go to slide 39. So in knowledge-based errors, we have got no rules to guide us. We are on our own. And Houston, we do have a problem. So what are we going to do? Slide 40. Number one is defer to experts. If we haven't got experts around the table, there'll be somewhere, by a phone, who will help us. Get them on the phone. Get talking to them. We resolve knowledge-based errors by trial and error. We'll try this. If that doesn't work, we'll try that. What we really have to think is, what is the best way to reduce the number of tries before we get control here? And we've got to be mindful of those errors we talked about on the last slide. We've got to test our hypothesis, but importantly, we've got to adopt high reliability theory. And whenever possible, we try and make rules, obviously not in an outbreak situation. So if we progress to slide 41, we're going to see high reliability theory explained. And this is the work of Wick and Sutcliffe and some excellent thinking they've done to come up with this. And basically, high reliability theory describes five characteristics that denote mindfulness. They enable us to cope and to manage outbreaks and to increase our reliability. So we're going to take a look at these five characteristics individually. So we'll go to slide 42. So number one, we've talked about already, deference to expertise. We have to ask, in this situation, who are the experts and are they around the table? And if they're not, we get them around the table. And it doesn't matter what the rank is here. Quite often, auxiliaries are more common. That auxiliaries maybe would take away commodes, and they know more what C. diff smells like than the ward manager, maybe even than the infection prevention and control nurse. And if that person is saying, I think this is C. diff, then we defer to them. We treat it as that situation. Maybe that's the patient that gets the cubicle. So that's very important. Okay, so that's deference to expertise. We'll move on to slide 43, and the second characteristic is a reluctance to simplify. Okay, so if you've come up with this great hypothesis of how X caused Y, what you want to ask is, tell me what's wrong with this. Tell me how I could be making a mistake here. You want to look for lots of explanations that it could be, and don't just stop at the first one that you like. And it's never, as we said, just a lack of hand hygiene. You should look to disprove your own explanation. And the military have a term which is called shark. And somebody who's a shark in an outbreak meeting is there just to pull holes in the decision. So not to participate like anyone else around the table, but to participate and pull holes. What could be wrong in that suggestion that somebody else has been put forward? And it's very important to encourage everyone to have an opinion on this if we're going to be safe. So our next characteristic is a sensitivity to operations. So we are humans and we will fail, and systems designed by humans will also fail. So ask, where are we most likely to fail? How could we make ourselves less likely to fail? Things always go wrong on bank holiday Mondays when we're focusing perhaps on one outbreak and there's another outbreak brewing that perhaps we're not recognizing as also very important. And sometimes the organism isn't easily detectable by current tests, and it will be everywhere before we know it. But our patients are going to be vulnerable. We are humans, and the systems are designed to fail. Your patients are vulnerable. Your hospitals are vulnerable to outbreaks. And that's why you've got a career in infection prevention and control. So slide 45 is commitment to resilience. And commitment to resilience is about asking, you know, good as we are, how can we make it better? What is the literature telling us is brewing? What are emerging threats on the horizon? And are we ready for it? What can make our team stronger? Perhaps even considering doing a pre-mortem on your own outbreak policy or your own outbreak tools, just the errors. Most importantly, publish your outbreak report. And this will enable others to improve their commitment. And just how many of us are sitting there with three outbreak reports we missed? If we don't publish, we're not going to make things better for everybody. And slide 46 is the final characteristic, and that's preoccupation with failure. Where are you going to go wrong next? where is your weakest? And referring back to that Herald of Free Enterprise, that boat that rolled over, you want to know what ships are setting sail in your hospital with the bow doors open. That's what you need to be on the lookout for.
Slide 47 is a present from Bill Gates. Doesn't give many presents, but here's his present. And he says, you know, it's great to celebrate success, which we're all good at doing these days, but it's more important to learn the lessons of failure. So really understanding what went wrong and how you can put it right. And again, publishing wherever possible. Slide 48 then is putting together what we need to do. So we need a debrief. Now, as soon as an outbreak's over, there's outbreak fatigue because the day job's been put on hold and it's just been getting bigger in our absence. It's very important that we do a debrief. We have to understand that the system failed, and we have to understand how the system failed so that we can design out an outbreak without designing in further unintended consequences. Okay. Next two slides, slide 49 and 50, show excerpts from our debrief tool. And the first part of our debrief tool has got speech commas, so for people to put in comments. And this is one of the really useful things. Quite often when I start an outbreak and debrief, I've used this one about 10 times now, people always come out with compliments about infection prevention and control team, which they weren't expecting to hear. Things like they were always there when I called them, they always listened to our concerns. And it's good to have these aired, and I'm sure the IPCT teams appreciate actually saying what they think was good about the support they got from their clinical colleagues as well. So quite often I often start with, I was listened to when I turn up with something like this. So very useful, and it also sets a nice positive atmosphere for when you talk about the other things, which is the blue boxes, which are, what could we have done better? What did we get wrong? Sometimes it's a bit of a confessional, and sometimes I remember one where they forgot to tell the ward staff that they were going to do a press release, and the relatives came in and kind of bashed them over the head with the local newspaper. So that kind of thing, it's good to air it. How are we going to make sure that thing doesn't happen again? And as I said already, the infection prevention control teams in other clinical areas are not telepathic. You need to actually pass on the lessons that you have learned in order for them to have to get the benefit of them. So slide 50 is really just showing you an excerpt from the debrief tool, but basically it follows the outbreak checklist. As the outbreak checklist is how you handle an outbreak, then this tool here is allowing you to say, how did we do? Did we get it all right? What did we miss? And more importantly, what could we have got better this time, even if it was good? And that's obviously that high reliability characteristic of commitment to resilience. So slide 51 is some work from the CT Labs. They're really worth a look on the website. And this is one of those cycles that happen, because quite often when people are putting things right after an outbreak, one of the things they will recommend is, let's stick in another step. Sticking in another step, making them sign another bit of paper to say they've done it, doesn't actually help them very much, because you haven't given them any more resource, you haven't helped them in any other way, you just put in another step. And the more steps around the procedure, the more complicated it is, and quite often we just shift where a disaster is going to happen. So this is a schematic to bear in mind when you're trying to put it right. And what we said at the beginning, just because you intended to put it right doesn't mean that's what you're going to achieve. Okay, slide 52 is work by SPATH, and that's the probability of a mistake. So if you've got a 50-step procedure and you get every step in that procedure right 95% of the time, then actually you're only going to get the procedure right 6% of the time. Now, so that you know, if you wanted to make up an IV drug, it's a 72-step procedure. So that's how complicated healthcare is, and we have to really understand this from the perspective of the healthcare worker. And I don't have time to direct you, but if I did, I would have a checkout of Reasons Vulnerable System Syndrome. It's very important. So that was a whistle-stop tour, and probably a bit quicker than I intended. I don't think I started with an apology, but I would do that. So the whistle stop tool for HET and HRT, I hope nobody comes in and thinks we're thinking about hormone replacement therapy, but it's about what we're likely to forget, what we are likely to apply, which is perhaps the wrong rules, the right rules badly, and what we're likely to meet are situations that we haven't met before. So on slide 54, this is my last slide, just to sum up, it's about understanding how we and our systems are likely to make errors. And if we know how we're likely to make errors, we can come up with the wherewithal to be more resilient. And mindfulness leads to resilience. So that's my slide. And I'm going to, there's a few definitions there which you can peruse at your leisure. But I'm going to hand you back to Martin now to take over as chair.
Tom, thanks very much for that. I have to say, when I first saw slide 80, I thought you were going to describe the inner workings of a nuclear reactor to us. You've beautifully gone through the potential for outbreaks, which is a constant, and we have to remember that, and that our day job. I think you summed up what we do in infection prevention control beautifully in that we stop outbreaks. You know, if we have to do it in one sentence, you know, because people often say, what do you do for a living? And I sort of struggle. So I thought that was really good. Thanks very much indeed. It remains for me now to thank Yvonne for today's absolutely excellent teleclass. So she's not what Boswell have described as the giant's causeway, worth going to, you know, worth seeing, but not worth going to see. Yvonne, if you see her on the programme anywhere, is always worth going to see and listen to. And I've really enjoyed today's session as much as any I've ever listened to in the teleclass series. Can I remind people that we've got several teleclasses coming up over the next couple of weeks. There's innovation and implementation strategies to reducing catheter-related bacteremias by Dr. Walter Zing on the 29th of January, followed by Dr. Barry Cookson, ex of the Public Health England, universal MRSA screening, is it worthwhile, and other fantastic presentations coming up. And can I also thank the patron sponsors of Telecast Education, Virox Technologies, the World Health Organization, and the Center for Research on Environmental Microbiology, and of course Paul Weber, who, without whom we wouldn't be doing any of these teleclasses. I hope you enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you very much for listening.